I think we should take these allegations seriously, regardless of the length of time, the passage of time.
Alaska senators weigh in on the sexual assault accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 17th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, hundreds of people turn out to count endangered beluga whales near Anchorage.
When I came here and actually saw the belugas, oh my gosh, it was pretty amazing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Federal officials announced charges this afternoon against a Kotzebue man in the case of a missing girl who was found dead last Friday. U.S. attorneys are charging 41-year-old Peter Wilson with making false statements to federal agents. In charging documents from the U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI Special Agent Michael Watson says investigators tracked the movement of a GCI cell phone that belonged to 10-year-old Ashley Johnson Barr. Based on geolocation data from the phone, searchers looked in a secluded patch of tundra about 2 miles outside town and found the young girl's body on Friday afternoon. By that point, the FBI had interviewed Wilson about his potential involvement in the disappearance. According to Chloe Martin, a spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage, Wilson broke the law by intentionally misleading federal agents.
They caught him in the lies, as alleged in the criminal complaint.
The documents suggest Wilson knew Johnson Barr. He was allegedly borrowing a four-wheeler at the time the young girl went missing on September 6th. Wilson had her cell phone in his jacket pocket that evening, according to an acquaintance of his who spoke to investigators. Wilson was arrested and brought to Anchorage over the weekend. Federal investigators have been working closely with state and local officials on the case. Martin says no murder charge has been filed.
The investigation is ongoing. However, we have been talking to the state the whole time, and everyone agreed to the current federal charge. As to other charges, we'll have to just see what evidence develops.
Wilson has a hearing in federal court in Anchorage tomorrow. Kotzebue is a close-knit community, and the 8-day search for Johnson Barr brought an outpouring of support from all across Alaska. Both of Alaska's U.S. senators said today they need to hear more about the allegations of a California professor who says Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were high school students more than 30 years ago. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says Professor Christine Blasey Ford should give her account under oath and Judge Kavanaugh should respond under oath.
I think we should take these allegations seriously, regardless of the length of time, the passage of time.
Ford says Kavanaugh pinned her down and tried to rape her in an isolated room while a party was underway. She says his movements were hampered by intoxication and she managed to escape. Kavanaugh denies the allegation and says he never attended the party she describes. Murkowski says facts can be hard to establish after more than 30 years, and she says teenagers often do things that are impetuous, foolish, or just plain dumb. But she says youth can't provide a blanket excuse for bad behavior.
Is there a statute of limitations that says once you hit this age, anything that happened before that time is kind of off the books? No, I don't think that that is the case. But I do think that we need to be fair with this.
Murkowski is closely watched as one of only two Republican senators considered possible no votes on Kavanaugh. Senator Dan Sullivan announced he'd support Kavanaugh after meeting with him this summer. But as state attorney general and as a senator, Sullivan has made women's safety one of his signature priorities, and he now says he wants to hear more. Sullivan read from a prepared statement.
My view is both Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh deserve the right to be heard on this matter. I commend Chairman Grassley on committing to as much and will be following closely as these claims are evaluated, reviewed, and the Judiciary Committee continues to look at them.
Sullivan did take one question.
It's whether you think something like this that one might have done in high school could ever be disqualifying.
Again, I'm just going to wait for the context.
Sullivan says the question opens up avenues he believes will be explored. A public hearing on the allegation is now scheduled for September 24. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska will take a 7.5% cut under a proposed salmon treaty deal with Canada. That's according to a proposed 10-year extension of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
For more than 30 years, the Pacific Salmon Treaty has allocated salmon stocks shared between the U.S. and Canada. It's renegotiated every 10 years. This latest version expires at the end of the year. Formal talks finished in mid-August. Now the numbers are out. Alaska will accept a 7.5% reduction compared to 12.5% for Canada. In Washington and Oregon, the cuts range between 5 to 15%. Alaska Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Charlie Swanton headed Alaska's delegation.
There's some that would consider it to be winners and losers, and I think in this case, I think everybody was equally disappointed.
It's unclear just what the 7.5% cut will mean for Alaska's fisheries, but it will certainly mean less fishing time and other conservation measures. Reaction was mixed. Samantha Weinstein, executive director of Southeast Alaska Guides Organization, said cuts were inevitable.
The decrease is unfortunate. We always regret losing the opportunity for clients to catch even just one more fish, but conservation needs to be put first.
But Alaska's troll fleet, which has seen historic reductions in its lucrative Chinook catch this summer, had urged delay.
It's always been crystal clear that we don't want any cuts.
Amy Doherty is executive director of the Alaska Trollers Association.
You know, we have, of course, a variation of opinion throughout our organization, but no one wanted cuts.
Commercial fishermen, most of them trollers, held rallies in recent months, urging the governor not to commit to more cuts. Some appealed directly to President Donald Trump, calling it a bad deal for Alaska. Governor Bill Walker met with treaty critics. In a statement, Walker said he'd explored a one-year delay, but decided it wasn't feasible. He called the outcome the best deal possible for Alaska. Sitka troller Kevin Pfeiffer said that'll be remembered come November.
The troll fleet is not going to take this lying down. This is going to be something that Governor Walker has to deal with this fall when he's running for re-election.
Chinook salmon returns are at historic lows. Swanton said federal biologists warned that the existing treaty is inadequate to conserve threatened fish species.
And if we didn't have a treaty, it is likely, and it has happened in the past, where some provisions of the Endangered Species Act would essentially be affecting how the state of Alaska operates our salmon fisheries in Southeast Alaska.
In other words, it could invite federal intervention into the state's fisheries. The ink's not dry yet. The deal is still pending legal review in Washington and Ottawa. Only then can it be formally ratified by diplomats from both countries. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Three senior Department of Health and Social Services administrators resigned on Friday. Commissioner Valerie Davidson has named two acting replacements and a new permanent CEO of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. The changes came 2 days after the release of a report that found Alaska's only state-run psychiatric hospital is an unsafe place to work. Department spokeswoman Katie Marquette declined to comment on whether the changes were related to the report. She says it's a personnel matter. Davidson sent a letter to all Division of Behavioral Health employees. Marquette says the letter let them know they can contact the new administrators.
She encouraged them to reach out to these newly appointed individuals to talk to them about how these changes will impact the Division of Behavioral Health and the entire department going forward.
The state hired a private law firm to investigate whether API employees are safe at work, as well as whether there is retaliation by management against employees, and if the facility is a hostile work environment. Attorney Bill Evans wrote the report after conducting confidential interviews with current and former staff. He concluded that several factors make it dangerous to work at API. Marquette says the division will continue to make a series of changes, Davidson outlined at a press conference on Wednesday about the report. They include raising the pay for psychiatric nurses at API. That pay hike occurred on Sunday. Marquette says this will improve the institute's ability to attract and retain nurses.
It's really challenging to recruit psychiatric nurses at API when those positions make substantially less than their counterparts in the private sector.
Along with the psychiatric nurses' pay increase, the 80-bed institute is looking to hire 20 new nurses. The increases in staff and salaries were included in the state budget for this year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, residents in Mountain Village aren't getting the help they need to cope with an extreme mental health crisis.
A 15-year-old girl tried 5 times to commit suicide. Doesn't that scream more than help?
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Federal wildlife managers organized an event over the weekend based on a really basic principle. You're more likely to care about something if you can see it. Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk has this story about the army of citizen scientists that assembled Saturday to count an endangered species near Anchorage.
On Saturday morning, I was standing with a bunch of college students at a pullout off the Seward Highway, just south of Anchorage. We were looking for beluga whales as part of a count organized by federal managers. Okay, there was actually a 2-minute break where I made a phone call, so I missed the whales. But I asked Brooke Faulkner about it afterward. She's one of the students.
And then all of a sudden, I was like, it's right there! It's like within 50 feet of us. And
really?
I was like, yeah!
Faulkner says she saw 2 belugas. Scientists estimate that there are about 330 in the inlet, down from more than 1,000 a few decades ago. The federal government named Cook Inlet beluga whales as an endangered species in 2008. Biologists think hunting originally caused the decline, but even though it's stopped, the population hasn't recovered, and scientists aren't exactly sure why. John Kurland works with NOAA Fisheries, the agency that's responsible for protecting the whales. I talked to him Saturday at an overlook at Point Warren's off, where he and a colleague were beluga spotting.
They just didn't bounce back the way we expected they would. So the question then is, once you remove that immediate source of mortality, if they're not bouncing back from that, what else might be hindering them? And again, is it food? Is it noise? Is it contaminants? Is it something else that we just haven't thought of yet?
The process to list Cook Inlet belugas as endangered was really contentious, in part because of fears about how beluga protections could interfere with commerce in Cook Inlet. The inlet has offshore platforms producing oil and gas. There's also a commercial fishing industry, and Anchorage's port is a hub for food, cars, and fuel shipped into the state. The state of Alaska and an oil company actually sued to block the beluga listing, though they lost. Now things are a little more cooperative. The state chairs a beluga recovery team alongside the federal government, and oil company workers looked for whales from their platforms in Cook Inlet on Saturday. Federal managers say they think events like the count are helping to build public support for belugas. Here's Donna Weeding, a top NOAA Fisheries official who is also at Point Warren's off.
We all care about tend to care about things that are in our backyard, right? And things that we can see, and that we take some sort of ownership in the sense of yes, we care about these species because we can see them.
Weeding works in the Washington, D.C. area supervising protections for dozens of endangered animals. She says her agency tries to get people spotting other species, too. All along the West Coast, there are whale trail stations where people can look for orcas. Julia Grindstaff says that idea makes sense to her. She was also at Point Warren's off on Saturday. She moved to Anchorage a few years ago and says she got way more excited about belugas after she saw them in Cook Inlet.
I've been landlocked in Illinois and Colorado, so when I came here and actually saw the belugas, oh my gosh, it was pretty amazing. And it does make it more real to you and than just seeing it on television or hearing about it.
She says she calls the belugas the ghosts of the inlet.
When I saw how they come up and they go down so quick and it's so smooth and you're like, so yeah, I like that.
I didn't see any belugas Saturday, but organizers said they had just under 2,000 people show up who spotted an estimated 100 whales. From a belugaless spot on the Seward Highway, I'm Nat Herz.
The U.S. Forest Service is on a tour through Southeast Alaska and Anchorage to talk about the prospect of building new roads in wilder parts of the Tongass National Forest. The controversial initiative, which was announced in August, is up against a November deadline. Last week, the Forest Service held its first public meeting in Juneau. Elizabeth Jenkins with Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
The Forest Service wasn't taking any formal public comment from the crowd of more than 50 people. Instead, there were maps stuck to the wall with blue scotch tape to spur discussion. After some presentations from the Forest Service, the floor was opened up for a roughly 40-minute Q&A. In 2016, a Forest Service plan for the Tongass included moving away from old-growth logging. It was created with years of community input from people on both sides of the aisle, including conservation groups and the timber industry. Meredith Trainer, the director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, wondered how the possibility of new road building in the Tongass would alter previous plans, like the one from 2016.
And in that case, that does take that process and kind of toss it out, right? This community process that we had.
I would disagree with that.
But the prospect of new road building wasn't on the table then. It's not for most national forests in the United States. Alaska has been fighting this for decades, and this latest attempt to greenlight new roads in the Tongass could potentially change that earlier management decision. Some in the audience question whether that seemed like a good idea.
You know, it's a guaranteed slippery slope.
Bart Kohler says he pretty much came out of retirement to make that point. He used to work for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council during the heyday of large-scale industrial logging. During his career, he says he saw some positive changes in the way the Tongass was managed, the roadless rule being one of them. Kohler says he's upset with how the Forest Service is conducting its current reevaluation.
This meeting format's a bunch of BS, you know, just a pile of bear scat. Because you come, you're interested, you want to say something, and none of these discussions are being recorded.
Kohler did get his questions in, though, and he's going to submit a written comment by October 15th when the deadline closes. A lot of people attending the Juneau meeting wore green stickers that said, "Keep roadless in the Tongass." Eric Nichols from Alcan Forest Products in Ketchikan wasn't one of them.
I'd been up looking at timber in other places, so Juneau was a stopover because of the plane schedule.
Nichols acknowledged there didn't seem to be much representation from industry in the room. But he says these issues extend beyond Juneau, to small communities where people are still employed by logging. It's estimated there are a few hundred timber jobs left. However, Nichols doesn't think that'll be the case for long if there isn't easier access to trees.
We've lost the balance. The balance is just totally off the scale. We've got everything in protection and conservation, but nothing, very little into what's going to generate economic activities.
The next Forest Service meeting on road building in the Tongass will be in Ketchikan on September 17th. The governor's office still needs to appoint a 13-person advisory committee to help inform the decision. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
A rat is loose on St. Paul Island, and that's a big deal because the Pribilof Islands have always been rat-free. Steve Delahanty, refuge manager for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, says rats bring significant economic and environmental concerns.
They damage people's property, they damage food storage, they damage ship and boat electronics, they damage wildlife, they eat birds, they eat bird eggs, they eat ticks. They can also transmit diseases.
For more than two decades, the Pribilof Islands have implemented a rat prevention program to keep the island rat-free.
They maintain year-round, 365 days a year, traps in strategic locations near the docks at St. Paul so that if a rat does come off a boat, hopefully it will be captured right away.
During that time, six rats have been killed, but Delahanty says this is the first to make it past the traps near the docks. A rat sighting was first reported in late August at the Trident Fish Processing Plant and is still at large. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working alongside Trident and the city and tribal governments to find it. The quick response, Delahanty says, may help stave off the worst-case scenario: breeding rats. For now, organizations on the island are working diligently to find the intruding rodent. They've set up a camera and they're planning to send a strike team of experts to the island this week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta has one of the highest suicide rates in the country, and communities aren't getting the resources they need to cope with it. Last week, we heard from Anna Bill, a village police officer in Mountain Village who has responded to dozens of suicide attempts this year. Today, KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis takes a look at one of the things that makes Anna's job so frustrating, the YK Delta's overburdened healthcare system.
It's a little after midnight at Mountain Village's police station, and VPO Anna Bill walks in with a thick stack of papers.
This is just the last couple months.
She's holding a pile of Title 47s. That's a form that law enforcement uses to place involuntary holds on people who pose an immediate threat to themselves or others. Anna fills out a lot of them.
And it's a whole stack.
By Anna's count, over 50 Mountain Village residents have attempted suicide in the past year, and she's worked to save each one of them. As the community's first responder, she's also the first person to decide whether a survivor needs further mental health treatment. She gets on the phone with the Behavioral Health Department at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the YK Delta's hospital. A clinician performs an assessment by phone or video conference. If a suicide survivor is still at risk, then Anna fills out a Title 47 form, and the patient is flown to Bethel's hospital for further treatment. The problem, Anna says, is that plenty of survivors are sent right back to Mountain Village. She says she's helped save children who've attempted suicide multiple times, some as young as 11 or 12, who were sent home from the hospital the same day they arrived.
But there's another one on her. Four repeats so far on just one person. Five.
That patient is receiving residential treatment now, Anna says, but she thinks she should have gotten that kind of intensive care a lot sooner.
A 15-year-old girl tried five times to commit suicide. Doesn't that scream more than help?
When a suicide survivor is titled, behavioral health workers follow a specific protocol to treat them.
Once they arrive at the hospital, the clock starts.
Jim Sweeney is YKHC's vice president of hospital services. He says behavioral health's clinicians have up to 24 hours to assess whether patients pose an immediate threat to themselves or others. As soon as they don't, Sweeney says that the hospital's legally required to release them, which is one of the reasons suicide survivors fly back to their villages so quickly. But Sweeney says that behavioral health's case managers try to keep track of these patients. They offer them counseling and psychiatric treatment, and they make follow-up calls to see if they need more help.
That happens within a few days after they leave here.
That's the way it's supposed to work. But over the past few months, KYUK has spoken to half a dozen former employees of YKHC's behavioral health department, as well as other healthcare workers who've worked closely with them. All of these sources ask to remain anonymous. They said that suicide survivors rarely receive the follow-up care they need. One former behavioral health employee said that over 90% of patients never receive a follow-up call from the department's case managers or intake coordinator. Another said that patients routinely tell them they, quote, just never heard back from the behavioral health department. When KYUK asked Jim Sweeney about this, he said he's never seen that happen.
Could it happen? Sure. We're a human system. When we hear about it, when we know about it, we reach out to that person and we make sure that it's not happening again. But I think a lot of times it's rumor, it's innuendo, it's very hard to fight a negative like that.
Former behavioral health employees also said that suicide survivors and other patients aren't required to schedule follow-up appointments before the hospital releases them, which Sweeney confirmed. That just isn't allowed at other hospitals, like North Star or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Ron Hale is the CEO of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and he says that Medicare and Medicaid require his staff to schedule follow-up appointments with patients before they can be released.
And it's just, to be honest with you, it's just good patient care.
And if you live in the villages, it can also be hard to schedule any follow-up appointments in the first place. YKHC's Jim Sweeney says that about 50% of patients who pass through behavioral health decide against doing any follow-up treatment, and behavioral health's clinicians are seriously understaffed.
It's a different life out here, and sometimes it just isn't what they expected it to be, and they don't stay with us.
YKHC is trying to fix this. They're constantly hiring and expanding, and its new facility will include more beds for cases like these. The hospital is trying to provide holistic mental health care to a remote region the size of Oregon, and that involves a lot of challenges that are out of YKHC's control. For instance, Sweeney says the hospital regularly refers patients to state hospitals for further treatment, but there's often no place to put them.
Just a statewide shortage of beds for people like that. It does happen regularly.
The Alaska Psychiatric Institute is one of those hospitals. CEO Ron Hale freely admits that his organization struggles to retain a large enough staff to care for its patients.
In order for me to provide safe staffing to the hospital, I've actually closed down 22 beds.
According to Allison Kulas, the executive director of the State Suicide Prevention Council, this all comes down to the state's budget.
I think that's a huge issue. A lot of times it does come down to funding. And I think we're in challenging times here.
In the meantime, first responders in the YK Delta's villages are doing what they can. Annabelle tells me about one woman whose life she saved a few times this year.
I go pick her up. She comes in. She gets titled. I send her off. She comes back that same day or that next day, that next week or the week after. She's attempted again. So I go back and pick her up, retitle her, resend her off. She comes back again.
In the face of all of these obstacles, Anna says, communities need to do what they can to care for suicide survivors themselves. Reporting in Mountain Village, I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
If you or one of your loved ones is struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can call the Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us, you can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Nat Herz in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jacob Resnick, Elizabeth Jenkins and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.